Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I am your host, Jimmy Traina. Thanks for joining me. This episode will feature two segments. First segment will be an interview with the longtime voice of the New York Yankees, John Sterling. John has been calling Yankee games on the radio since 1989 and has not missed one game in that span. 29 years, not missed a game, and he's going to be 80 years old in July. So we spoke to John about his career, lengthy career. He's done games with the Braves, the Hawks, the Nets, sports talk radio. Lengthy career. We get into it all. So you'll hear from John Sterling, the radio voice of the New York Yankees first. And then after that, my boss, the managing editor of Sports Illustrated, and director Jonathan Hock joined the program to talk about an upcoming documentary that's going to air later this season on SITV about the 1978 Yankees-Red Sox battle. The documentary is going to be called 14 and a Half Back, and Chris and Jonathan, who has done a bunch of 30 for 30s and is a phenomenal director, tell you what to expect. There is so much stuff in that 78 season that you've forgotten or you may not know about, and it's going to make for a tremendous documentary. So if you want to relive some of that magic from the 78 season, that interview is for you. So that comes up after John Sterling, who kicks things off right now on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Okay, joining me now on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, big thrill for me. If you have read my column over the years on SI.com, you know I'm an enormous fan of this man, the voice, the only voice of the New York Yankees, John Sterling. Hi, John.
Well, hello. Thank you. What a nice introduction.
My pleasure. I am, like I said, a big fan. I'm one of these people who turns down the sound on the TV and puts you and Susan on the radio. And
bless you.
And I thank you for all of the entertainment over the years.
Well, frankly, I do get that. It's wonderful when I hear it. But, you know, as they say, first of all, it's my pleasure. And, you know, I'm very lucky that I'm able to combine my vocation with my avocation. I mean, I love what I'm doing, so it truly is a labor of love. So thank you.
I don't think anyone can dispute that you love what you do. And I want to start with something. I want to get a clarification and just be 100% sure of something, because I have written columns about this and I tweet about this often. And I think it's probably the most underrated stat in sports and one of the greatest stats in sports. And I want to get confirmation. You've been calling the Yankees since 1989. Almost, it's 29 years. Next year will be your 30th season doing it. You have not missed an inning, correct?
Well, just about. Well, with Susan, I do all the play-by-play, so I haven't missed an inning, and this is either our 14th or 15th year. I haven't missed a game in the 30 years with the Yanks. And if you really want to go back, Jimmy, I haven't missed a game that I was scheduled to broadcast since I began with the Hawks in November of 1981. So this would be my 38th season without missing a game. And then there were 5 years in there when I did the Hawks and the Braves, and I was probably broadcasting about 120 games a year.
Obviously, it's a remarkable, remarkable feat. And I think the grind of baseball to do 162 games a year, which is what you do, to not miss one game since 1989 when you started as the Yankees in the radio booth for the Yankees, is remarkable. What do you attribute? Obviously, luck has to be a factor, but what else do you attribute this unbelievable streak to?
You know, I don't think about it, and you know, people ask me about the streak. I don't honestly think about it. I just do it, and I like what I do. I look forward to about every game, and for example, tonight is the final game of this road trip, which has been tough for reasons other than baseball, and it's like mind over matter. When I begin the game, I'm so into the game that I really don't think of anything else. And but you are right; it is luck or genes or something that I've been able to do this without getting sick during the season.
Have you ever come close to missing a game?
Well, I don't think I've ever come close to missing a game. I've been sick,
right?
But I don't know how, but I was very sick one afternoon in Los Angeles before a Hawks game, and I lay down for a couple of hours, and when I got up, I was fine. And, you know, there have been times when I've been sick. One time during a Red Sox doubleheader, I really got sick, food poisoning.
Oh, boy.
And Susan was with me then, and I had to, in the second game, I had to leave between innings, but I usually got back, and I mean, I always got back, and just my luck that night when I really, really was sick in Boston, it was a split doubleheader, and to fill the time between games, I ate, and I obviously ate something that disagreed with me, and it turned, the second game turned out to be the longest 9-inning major league game in history.
but the way they drew it up.
But the next day, Gene Monahan, our great trainer, Gino, gave me a potion, and that took care of that, and I was okay.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that. It's amazing it only happened once. Your resume is so extensive. You mentioned the Hawks. You've done the Nets, the Islanders, the Braves, Yankees, obviously, for the last bunch of years. Has your broadcasting philosophy, if you even have one, how has it changed over the years? I'm just curious. 70s, 80s, 90s, now we're here.
Well, you know, I don't want to sound too shallow, although I am. I don't have a philosophy. I don't work things out. How am I going to do today? I live my life by the seat of my pants, and I broadcast by the seat of my pants. And so, I do what I do when I, you know, do it. I don't really think about it, and I would say, now I hope I've improved. I hope I'll always keep improving. I'll always find better ways to do things. Tony Bennett once said that Pablo Casals was learning new techniques in his 90s. So, you know, you hope to improve, but usually when I go on the air, I do what I do when I go on the air. Mm-hmm. They turn on the red light, and they point at me, and I open my big fat mouth and go. And if there's a philosophy, I guess that's it. I just fly.
Right.
Kurt Gotti once said, when you're doing radio baseball, you know, you and your engineer and your partner, and you fly like a bird. In other words, it's so different than TV, mm-hmm. which is so orchestrated, and you have a director in your ear all the time. Well, I have no one. I do have a great producer, engineer, in Jack Maldonado. He's the best I've ever had in all my years, and I've been at it a long time. But I don't think about it. That's the biggest thing I do. I just do it.
I'm curious. You mentioned TV. I know you've done TV in the past, obviously, but with the Yankees since '89, it's been radio only. Have you ever had a desire in your time with the Yankees to do TV, or you're 100% perfectly content doing the radio?
I'm 100% totally satisfied in doing radio baseball. I have done TV on Yes. I've done some football and basketball games.
Right.
In Atlanta, of course, there were four of us on baseball, and two of us would start on radio, two would start on TV, and we would cross at the end of four and a half. So I was doing TV all the time, and with the Hawks, I did their TV along with radio, and sometimes I did simulcasts. But I would say the quote-unquote television, which I guess people think is a big thing. In baseball, I don't know if it is a big thing. Baseball is very much of a radio sport. So with the Yankees, I'm very happy doing radio.
And being with the Yankees being the juggernaut they've been since basically 94, 95, 96, you get the benefit of doing all those postseason games, where if you were doing Yes or the television side of it, you don't get to do the postseason games.
Yeah, I think that's terrible.
Yeah.
A guy who follows his team all year long and then can't do the playoffs, and I know the TV guys don't like it at all. Those are the games you want to do.
Of course, yeah. I'm just curious. You may think it's boring. I'm fascinated by it. I'd be curious if you don't mind. Yankees have a home game. Can you take me through your daily routine from when you wake up to when you're back home? I'm just curious how you, what your prep is for the game, when you're at the stadium, what you do before a game, after a game.
I'd be glad to tell you, but you'll find it very boring.
I doubt it.
I'm not, well, because First of all, I don't write anything down. I don't do a broadcast that way.
Right.
I try to do as few stats as possible, except things that I think are important or really interesting. But, for example, let's talk about this Friday, since you want to do this. Good idea, I guess. This Friday, we'll be home. Now, we have a day off tomorrow.
Yay!
And, you know, they never give the Yankees because they're a big draw. And they're good for TV ratings. They never give the Yankees a getaway day game. Now, this is a great example today.
Yep.
The Cardinals in Kansas City are playing getaway day game. If we had a getaway day game, you know, starting, let's say, now, you know, you'd finish at 4 or 5, whatever. The Yankee games take a long time, and then it's a long trip. But you'd get home, let's say, at 9 or 10 or 10 or 11.
Mm-hmm.
And get a decent night's sleep. Well, we're going to play a night game, and we're going to get home like 3 or 4 in the morning, and drives you nuts. That's the toughest part of the job by far.
The travel, yeah.
And so I have an ability. I'm a late person, and I think I was a late person when I was a kid. So it isn't just that I've been working late all these years, but that's also part of it. So when I get home, I'm one of those. I mean, you probably feel this way yourself. I can't go to sleep right away.
Right.
You know, when a guy finishes broadcasting a game, he's concentrating for all those hours, pitch by pitch. And at the end of the game, I can't fall asleep. It takes me a couple of hours. You know, I want to have maybe an adult beverage and watch something on TV or catch up with the latest scores or whatever it is I do.
I have to interrupt for 1 second. What is the John Sterling adult beverage of choice? I need to know.
Excuse me?
What is the John Sterling adult beverage of choice?
Well, for the most part, I drink either vodka or scotch.
Okay. I had to know that. Go ahead. Continue.
Anyway, so I'll go to sleep very late tonight, and but tomorrow, which is, as I say, an off day, you know, I'll do errands and whatever. So Friday when I get up, I'll have brunch, and usually very healthy in the morning or noon is when my brunch is. And then I'll have errands to do. I have to do a lot of things for myself. And,
right.
And I will, and I'll swim. I live in a fabulous apartment house, which has a pool downstairs, indoor pool. They have an outdoor, of course, but the biggest thing is they have an indoor pool. I can go downstairs, swim my half hour, get my workout in, and go upstairs and shave and shower and dress and make myself look absolutely gorgeous. And then...
For radio.
Then I'll go to the stadium and, you know, drive through New York traffic and over the GW Bridge. I live in New Jersey. And get to the stadium, you know, let's say around 5, and I do my lineups with Susan and Jack, and if a chance, I'll have a bite to eat, and then the game is on, and I broadcast the game, and I drive home and do the same thing.
Right.
Now, it occurs, this week is really different. We're playing Saturday night instead of Saturday afternoon, and then we play Sunday afternoon and Monday afternoon, which I think is Memorial Day.
Yes.
So those afternoon games are really tough for me because I have to get up early, obviously. And Sunday I have the radio show before the game, which is heard just on the local flagship, WFAN. Anyway, and so it goes day after day. Sunday, for example, after the afternoon game, we're having a big family party, a big family dinner, and I'm looking forward to that.
Nice.
I have 4 children.
Yep.
And... And on and on. I can't explain it. You know, people say, how do you prepare for the game? And my answer is, I've been preparing since I was 7 years old.
Right.
I mean, I don't have to do anything different.
Well,
I read the newspapers.
I was going to say, you got to know the players on the other team, I would think, would be the biggest challenge.
But I've been doing that all my life.
Yeah.
Of course I know the players on the other team.
Yeah.
And I grew up in an era before expansion when you knew every player on every team in hockey, basketball, baseball, and most of the stars in football. So, in other words, I don't have to work at it, Jimmy.
Yeah.
It's what I do for my life. I only do things I enjoy. And so I ignore everything else. So,
I have a couple of things to say about your schedule that I'm fascinated by. The first thing may sound very stupid, but I don't mind embarrassing myself. It's the least of my worries. I'm fascinated that you drive yourself to the games only because I would think 29 years on the job, the Yankees with all that money should have you get you a car and a driver. That's a bad job by the Yankees. John Sterling deserves a car and a driver if Hal or Randy Levine are listening to this.
To get in my own car and drive and have air on and have music on. I have usually Seriously Sinatra on Sirius XM.
Yep.
And so I have the music that I love every day. I'm very lucky. I've had sports and music as a companion, as two companions, since I was a little boy, since I was 7, 8, 9 years old. So anyway.
Few things better than those two things.
Excuse me?
There are only a few things in life better than those two things, that's for sure.
Yeah, and so I have those. So in other words, for me to prepare for the game or to keep up, well, I do it because I do it. If I was selling insurance, I would be involved in sports in some way
right. Because
I love it so much. So I really do want to find out what's happening in basketball and hockey, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And it's not work to me. It's something, as I said before, it's a labor of love. It's my labor, and I love it, so.
Are you not an internet user at all?
I am not an internet user at all.
Do you do email?
I do not.
Wow. Text message? Well, I think you do text message, right? Or no?
Yeah, I get texts, yes.
Okay. So no email, no internet. So you're a newspaper guy to find to.
Yeah, and I'm in a lot of trouble. I'll tell you a story to help your podcast, little stories.
Please.
I'm in a taxi in Boston a few years ago, and I always bring reading material. You know, that awful trip that you've heard about the Yankees had where we had to sit on a plane for 13 hours?
Ah, yes.
Well, I bring an overkill of reading, and so I open a book and I get involved, and you know when you get involved in a book, boy, you don't want anyone to bother you. Mm. You're following this book. And I read nothing but things that entertain me. I think that is another thing I do in life, sports, music, et cetera. I only watch things, listen to things, read things that entertain me. And so, I forget my absolute dumb point. What was my dumb
about
point?
Not using the internet?
No, about Boston, yeah. So I bring an overkill of reading all the time. So I'm in this back of this cab reading a newspaper, and we stop at a light, and this cab driver turns to me. He said, you know, buddy, he said, we're dinosaurs. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, we're the last people to read newspapers.
Yep.
Unfortunately, that's true. And if, you know, the rumors that you hear swirl that even newspapers are going to go just on the internet, I'm in a lot of trouble. That may force me to learn how to fool around with the internet.
Is it? I'm curious. I mean, we're just talking about the not using the internet age difference, perhaps. Do you ever have trouble? How your relationship with players on the Yankees? I'm curious. Do they all sort of recognize you as the voice of the Yankees, and there's a good relationship there, respect level? Is it hard to relate to them because they're so young and their heads are probably buried in their iPhones anytime you're trying to speak to them?
Well, that's not just the players. That's everyone. I swim, and I get to the end of the pool, you know, look up, and there are people sitting around the pool fiddling with their phones. And you get on a Yankee bus after the game, and everyone is fiddling with their phones. And you get on the plane, they're fiddling with their phones. And I have no problem relating to the players, even though I would say they're younger. And outside of one player, no, I'm not going to name because what's the point? And that was years ago, or more than 20 years ago. Every single player has always treated me with respect, just like the fans. You can't imagine.
Yeah.
Every day of my life, wherever I go, especially now, Jimmy, the people come over to our booth in Texas. They listen all the time. And all the fans treat me with respect. I'm really lucky. And I hear every single day, you know, how great the broadcasts are, yada, yada. And everyone wants to be recognized for their work, and we're in the public, so we're recognized. And
I would love to get the name of that player who is not nice to you. and so I can shame him.
Well, maybe off the air. Well, why bother? You know, he didn't do anything wrong. He just didn't answer me twice. I said hello twice. Once on Madison Avenue and once in a hotel where we were the only two people. He was getting out of an elevator and I was getting in and he ignored me. And so I never talked to him again. Big
right.
deal. Didn't bother me at all.
Yeah.
And other people, yeah, everyone else has just treated me marvelously. And I'm very fortunate.
Yeah.
I have become really friends with two of the Yankee managers, Buck Showalter and obviously Joe Torre. Anyway, when you look at all this, I've been very, very fortunate.
It irritates me beyond belief, but you do have some critics out there, mostly in the newspapers or whatever. Everyone in sports media has critics. I don't think there's anyone in sports media who doesn't have critics, but I don't know if it would be unfair to say you're a polarizing figure, but I think the majority of Yankee fans love you. I think there are people who have problems with maybe your broadcast style. Do you pay attention to it? Do you care about it? Or screw them and you're happy doing your thing?
No. In fact, you know, there's an old adage, and boy, is it true. You can't please everyone, and you shouldn't try. And so you don't have to tell me the way I broadcast. Obviously, there are people who don't like it. And the people who are getting paid for it, I really don't pay attention to anything they say because they're doing it for a reason. They're doing it for a living.
Well, also, the main guy who does it doesn't seem to like anything, and he's fairly miserable.
I would say when you knock someone for the 30 years I've been here, you obviously dislike the person.
Right.
So that makes me ignore it even more. So, no, I'm cool with that. I mean, and by the way, you know, you could say this too. I have very strong likes and dislikes. And so when I have a dislike, I just totally ignore it. I'll give you a great example. I don't think I've ever listened to rap for 5 consecutive seconds. And if you said to me, "Wow, do you keep up with the Kardashians?" No. do you watch the huge Housewives of Hawaii? No. So I don't watch those kind of programs. So I have, you know, the same likes. Not the same, but I have very strong likes and dislikes, so I understand it. So if you said, "Well, I have a friend who thinks you're the worst broadcaster in history," it wouldn't mean anything to me.
Good.
I would say to that person, "You shouldn't listen," but that's all.
Right. Could you name the three Kardashian sisters since you mentioned that?
Well, there's Kim.
Right.
Kim, Courtney, and Khloe.
Whoa! Congratulations. Now, there's two stepsisters who are Jenners. I don't want to put you on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know those two?
No, but I've never seen the show.
Yeah. Kendall and Kylie are the other two. But you got the three main ones, so that was a good job.
I always say to people, kiddingly, well, what do? Do they sing? Do they dance? No.
They make money. That's what they do. They make money.
Yeah.
So obviously, at the beginning of the season, Giancarlo became a huge thing for you, that call.
Which is amazing, right?
It was the number one story in New York for about 48 hours, it seemed like.
Well, isn't that amazing, a home run call?
It was the perfect storm.
They're all either little rhymes or they're play on words. I mean, it's not feeding the world's hungry. It's not curing diseases. It's just a nonsense, you know, something I do on the broadcast. I feel it, and I do it. Now, of course, it's become I started with Burn, Baby, Burn.
Right.
But with the Yankees, actually in Atlanta, it was Dominique is magnifique, but that was a long time ago.
I don't know if people inform you of this because I know you're not on Twitter, but I will tell you this. If the Yankees make a trade for a player, instantly on Twitter, there's a million tweets. What is John Sterling's home run call going to be for this player?
Yeah, now that has become a cottage industry.
Yes.
That becomes very tough. It was not intended to do for every player. And
was the
so
first
now
one?
I actually have to think. Where the other times, it just came out naturally. Yeah. A-bomb from A-Rod or Robbie Cano, don't you know? It just came out. I didn't think about it.
The first one was Burn, Baby, Burn, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Okay.
And he loved it.
Yes. Well, I think it did, if I'm not mistaken, I think it started with an afternoon game in Minnesota I think that was the first burn. I remember it, I think.
Well, I wouldn't remember that.
I could be wrong. Do you have
anyway, the fact that the Giancarlo thing became such a big thing.
Yeah.
It became so big that a critic who wants to knock me, desperately wants to knock me, and wants to embrace Susan so that there's someone, you know, that he likes and somebody dislikes. And he called Susan and said to her, does all this attention John is getting, does it bother you? And she said, no.
Right.
So silly. It's, yeah. The whole thing is, of course, it's not silly to him. That's his life. But yeah. Anyway, the Giancarlo thing is kind of a story within a story. When the Yankees got him, you know, everyone was saying, what's your home run call going to be? And I said, I have no idea, but you won't hear it until the regular season begins, even if he hits a home run in spring training, which he did. Mm-hmm. And I called up Berlitz, and they gave me a gal, their Italian master, a lovely gal named Linda Merlo. And I said to her, I need a phrase, an Italian phrase, to rhyme with Giancarlo. And I said, what I want, and I said, I hope you're old enough to know this, and Jimmy, I'm sure you'll know this. I said, I want something like Ronzoni Sono Buoni. Do you remember that?
Yeah, the pasta commercial, sure.
From the old days, yes.
Yep.
Ronzoni is so good. Ronzoni Sono Buoni. So a few days later, what do you think? She called back and said, I think I have something. And it was Giancarlo, non si può stopparlo, which means you can't be stopped.
Right.
And not only can you say stopparlo, you could also say Fed Marlo. I have an Italian girlfriend who told me that. Oh, you can also say Fed Marlo. Anyway, and then one of my buddies, the beat writer for the Bergen Record on the Yankees, a fellow named Pete Caldera, who really can sing. Mm-hmm. I mean, he sings Sinatra-ish.
Yep.
He really has a good voice. And he came in the booth a few days after everyone was buzzing about what is the heck is Sterling saying about non si può stopparlo. And he said, you know, John, I thought you were going to do something like, and then he sang. And he sang, non dimentica, that ball should travel far. And I added Giancarlo. So I do that too. And when someone, well, it's terrible, I can't stand. Well, don't listen. What do you want from me?
So you switched it over to the non dimenticare. Just was the heat you got for the first call a factor in that, or you just liked the second one better?
Oh, no. It's just something.
Yeah.
How can I explain this? This is not Secrets to the Newest Atomic Bomb. I mean, this is.
But see, here's the thing. You're downplaying it, but you have to understand the importance to Yankee fans. I will say this. Again, I don't want to make it about me and be a bad host and my ego. I will, anytime you have a new home run call, I tweet it out and I get hundreds and hundreds of responses. The Neil Walker one the other night was your first one for Neil Walker. I put it out there. Massive amount of people wait for it. It's you need to, you have to understand this is a big thing with the Yankee fans.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm very lucky. I'm not knocking it. I'm very lucky. I'm just saying it's not exactly what you would call important. And somehow it's heard everywhere. And after I did the home run call for Neil Walker, the home run corker, David Cohn is doing TV, and after the game he came and said, oh, I heard that. I love the Neil Walker one.
Yeah, that's it. There you go. Because it was probably on Twitter then.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you would say that's great, right?
Do you ever, when you're going around the league looking at box scores, do you ever say, oh, I wish the Yankees would get that player because I could do a good home run call for him?
No.
Okay.
Now, I think if we get people come up to me, what would your home run call be for me? And I did, I was a guest on my buddy Michael Kay's Center Stage last summer, I guess. And one of his questions was, what would your home run call be for me? Well, luckily his name is Kay, so I said, I said, Michael, you're okay. And the whole audience.
That's an easy one. Yeah.
Applauded, yes. Very easy.
When I told my friends I was speaking to you, they all wanted me to ask you for a home run call for me. And I said, I'm not doing that. That's his job. Leave him alone. I'm not putting him on the spot. So I can imagine people coming up to you constantly asking for that. That's got to get a little bit annoying.
It's become a thing.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm very, not I guess.
You know what else? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I guess I'm very fortunate that it's happened and that people... Also, you know one other thing, Jimmy?
Yep.
And this is true not just of me. This is true of every broadcaster. Your games can be heard everywhere.
Yep.
I cannot tell you how many people have come up underneath our booth in Texas where you can actually talk to us. The booth is higher than the walkway in back of the seats in the second deck. But people come talk to us. And people listen every day to the Yankee games. And they're in Dallas or Arlington, wherever they're living.
Yeah.
And so that for broadcasters, that's a great thing. And also another great thing is your highlights can be heard immediately.
Oh, yeah.
You know, my in-laws, who I love dearly, live in Sacramento. And, you know, I can do a home run in the afternoon, and they put on the news in the evening, and they can hear the call. So it's new age of electronics has aided broadcasters immeasurably.
And the home run calls get all the publicity, and rightfully so. But I don't know how aware you are, but you can't predict baseball also gets thrown around a lot whenever something
crazy happens.
My boy,
is that true?
Yeah. That,
and also, I'll give you another one. Excuse me. On the Fox coverage of the playoffs last year, Alex, who's a friend of Susan's and mine, and Big Poppy, they were doing my bits. I'm getting a phone call. I'm going to leave it alone.
Okay.
They were doing our bits. So they would do... Well, that's baseball, Susan,
yep.
And that's across the country. And we thought it was great, you know, and also you can't predict baseball. Boy, I use that a lot.
Yep.
And it's true.
Yes, it absolutely is true. You're not a – I don't want to go into a sour subject, so if you don't want to go there, just tell me. But you're not a fan of discussing age, if I'm not mistaken.
Excuse me, I'm not a fan of what?
Discussing age, right? You don't like to get into your age and how long you've been doing this or
– I don't care anymore.
Oh, you don't?
First of all, you know one reason why?
Why?
Because everybody can find out your age, and they ask your age on everything.
Right.
And it's also terrible about phone numbers. They find out the internet. They find out your phone number. I don't know how, but you give your phone number everywhere. I go to a cleaner's in the area where I live, and they identify you by your phone number. Well, what's your phone number? And you give your phone number. Oh, yes, and then they have your clothes for you.
Right.
So, I'm 79, and I've been on the air for a long time.
The only reason I bring it up is I think it's part of your awesome story. I mean, here you are, big one, obviously. I think your birthday is the 4th of July, same as George Steinbrenner. You're going to be 80 on the 4th of July, and here you are. You have not missed one Yankee game in 29 years, and like you said, going back. I think that's something that should be celebrated. I think it's a remarkable achievement. And you know.
Well, my feeling, first of all, I don't plan ever to retire. Secondly, I have young kids that keep me young. Thirdly, I have to get them through college. so, you know, I would be working regardless. But I feel the same way that I felt in my 30s or 40s. I'm very fortunate. I told you. I feel I don't take it for granted. I'm very fortunate. That probably has to do with genes, in which I had nothing to do with.
Right.
And I'm very fortunate, too, that my voice hasn't aged. You could listen to one of the broadcasters of Tampa, terrific broadcaster and really good guy named Andy Freed. And he came to me last year or the year before and said, I heard on YouTube an interview you had with Mel Allen in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I don't know how they do that, how it's possible, whoever recorded it. But he said to me, you know, you sound exactly the same. So, you know, that's good, too.
It's funny because I was born in the 70s. And when I hear someone mention the 70s, in my head, I think, oh, that wasn't that long ago. And then it's like, oh, it was a long time ago, the 70s. That staying power is impressive. You've already given me more time than I had asked. Can I do a couple of really quick rapid fire questions with you just to wrap it up here on some quick subjects.
Okay.
Do you have a favorite call of your career?
I can't, but I'll tell you one, just to give you a one. I don't. First of all, here's the thing, too. I never listen to tapes.
Okay.
Because when I listen to tapes, I think I could have done it better. So I never listen to tapes. And if I don't listen to my tapes, I certainly don't listen to anyone else's. But one night in the magical year of 96, the first game of the playoffs against the Orioles in the ALCS, that was the Jeffrey Mayer game.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it ended in the 11th inning when Bernie hit a home run off Randy Myers to win it, a walk-off home run. And I gave it the best call I could get. And, you know, people didn't think it was going to be – they wanted a fair foul. I just took a chance. And I had told my wife, who was there with friends, I'll meet you down, and I mentioned a certain bar in the 70s on the west side. And, well, I'll give them a plug, Blondie's. And because I had to do a long postgame, which I did, long postgame. And when I left the stadium, Mike Francesa and Chris Russo were doing postgame. They had to do the longest postgame in history.
Right, right.
And as I drove downtown from Yankee Stadium, Mike and the dog must have played the home run about 20 times. And so for all those reasons, that might be the call that I remember the most.
Mike and Chris like to take a lot of credit for a lot of things, but playing the John Sterling calls, they deserve credit for. They were the first ones to do it. Give me a call in sport. It doesn't have to be baseball. It could be any sport that you wish you made the call of.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think Babe Ruth pointing to center field and hitting a home run against the Cubs.
That's a good one.
That might have been a good call.
Yeah.
No, that's tough to do. I don't think about that either. It's funny. Basically, as I guess I've been saying over and over in different ways, I do it by the seat of my pants, so I don't think about those things.
All right, this
gee,
one...
what call would I have liked? I can't think. I mean, one jump shot, one...
Oh, miracle on ice, I don't know,
yeah.
You know, Norwood, wide left or wide right, whatever it was. I'll go to this then. Give me best baseball player you've ever seen, and I want the best Yankee player you've seen since 89.
Best Yankee player I've ever seen? Oh, I don't know. I mean, people I've seen. I guess, you know, you'd say Willie Mays, Henry Aaron.
Right.
Players like that. Mickey Mantle. I saw him. I saw Mays and Aaron and Frank Robinson, people like that. Frank Robinson, I was in Baltimore on the air and doing a talk show, and Frank came on my show for about 3 hours. Actually, the vice president of the United States, who was enmeshed in a lot of trouble, but when he was Baltimore County Executive, Spiro Agnew did my show all the time.
Wow.
3 hours. He'd sit there for 3 hours.
Unbelievable.
Frank sat there for 3 hours. I'm not answering your question because, I can't remember. Oh, the best player. Well, those, I guess they were the best players. It's very tough for me.
Best Yankee.
The best Yankee player?
Since 89, when you started.
Whoa.
I know who I would say. I'm curious.
Well, I wish I knew. Give me a hint.
I think you'd have to say Mariano.
Oh, okay. You mean, you know, you want to talk about luck? Do you know that I saw Mariano pitch in every game of his career?
Yeah.
And I saw Derek Jeter play every game of his career.
Phenomenal.
Every game. And I'll tell you a cute story. It's better. The stories are much better than these questions, that these answers. That, you know, it reminds me of TV. And, Jimmy, this you know. Every sports thing on TV, like radio, has a panel.
Yeah.
And they choose these subjects because they have to fill time.
Yep.
And the one sounds dumber than the other. And a writer named Brian Hoke, really good writer,
mm-hmm.
had been on the Yankee beat for a long time.
MLB.com, I believe.
Yes.
Yep.
And he went to Derek Jeter just before the end. And he said to him, you know, you know, John has seen every game you've played. And Jeter said, boy, he must be tired of seeing me. So you know what? Mariano is by far the best relief pitcher of all time, and so and the most unusual of all time. You see, all these other pitchers have one or two great years and then fall by the wayside.
Yep.
And Mariano must have been great 17 years in a row, starting in '96. So I congratulate. I didn't think of it. I would say that Mariano would have been the best.
When closers collapse, they collapse fast. It happened, and it never happened to him. It was crazy. I love it. When you sing during the games, you and Susan, I know, love musicals, Broadway. I love any and all singing during the games. I love the home run calls that had singing in them. Give me, I want your favorite singer and your favorite Broadway show of all time.
Well, this is another problem that I have, you know, about the best. Everyone says it's the best of all time.
I hate being asked the best, too, and I'm asking it to you.
I can't do it.
I'm just trying
to. They always say, who's better, Michael Jordan or LeBron?
Yeah.
By the way, I played basketball all my life, and I broadcast basketball. I'm as close to basketball as I am to baseball. And who's the best, Michael or LeBron? Did they ever hear of a guy named Bill Russell? I mean, it's a team game. And Russell won 11 championships in 13 years and revolutionized the sport. And there's never been another Bill Russell since. So, I mean, he has to be in that argument. And Oscar Robertson has to be in that argument, too. But nowadays, there are a lot of young kids, or young people, I should say, who are on the air, and they only know, which is understandable, of the game from the time that they started watching it or listening to it, and they don't know the history. A lot of the players don't know the history either, and they're missing an awful lot. And nowadays, you can go back, I guess, through the Internet, through different arms of the Internet, to actually see Bill Russell or whatever. But so, what was your question?
I asked you your favorite song and your favorite Broadway show, and you told me...
So point I was making is that it's impossible to choose if you like something. In other words, you say, well, what player do you like? Well, I could name 20 players.
Right.
What Broadway show? I've seen every great Broadway show, or I've heard the music. And when I'll give you an answer, because you want an answer, but I don't have any great feeling about the answer, because if you put on the music of another show, oh, no, that's my favorite. You know, I'm one of those.
Okay.
Favorite singer would be Frank. And I guess the favorite Broadway musical will be South Pacific.
All right. Those are good answers. That's good.
If you like them, yes.
Yeah. In wrapping up, I'm just curious. So it seems like, tell me if I'm wrong about this, the last few years, you're on like these one-year deals with FAN. Is that, or was your last deal a two-year deal?
Well, right now it is. You know, we'll negotiate the end of the year. It doesn't really matter.
Does that get tiring to you? Like, I feel like they should give you a lifetime contract. This is ridiculous, putting you on these short deals. You should be there till you want to go.
Well, the Yankees have told me that. But
okay.
I don't work directly for them. They have control. They have told me I'm there as long as, you know,
right,
as long as I want.
Well, if FAN wanted to get rid of you, I'm sure the Yankees would tell FAN that's not going to happen.
Right. But in broadcasting, they don't give. They take. And so they can't tell me what you're telling me because they think it's going to cost them money. So, you know, it's called business.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get the best deal for them, and I'm trying to get the best deal for me.
Well, you know, I think that's a perfect way to wrap this up is, you know, when I defend you to people, I think it's a few people, most people get it. And the people who don't get it, I try to explain. Sports is show business. It's entertainment. So if you're there and, you know, maybe you miss a pitch, but you're entertaining me in another way, that's what I'm interested in. It's okay,
right.
You know, so that's my philosophy on it. So I say that as a wrap up, and I thank you for coming on. And like I said, you're the voice of the summer for me and Yankee fans, and I appreciate it. And it was a fun interview, and I thank you for coming on.
Well, you're very kind, and I thank you for all your support. And I hope you come out to the stadium so we can meet.
Absolutely. I would like that. Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Okay, take care. All right. I enjoyed that. Hopefully the Yankee fans out there did. If you're not a Yankee fan, hopefully you got a little insight there into being a longtime baseball broadcaster. I think there's something there for everyone, even if you're not a Yankee fan. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it. Before we get to the next interview with Chris Stone of SI and Jonathan Hock, this episode of the SI Media Podcast is sponsored by Buffalo Wild Wings. Let me tell you about good old Buffalo Wild Wings. At Buffalo Wild Wings, we'll admit that we often go overboard with our limited time offerings. We just can't help ourselves. Take our new signature sampler. For $15, you get, now listen to this, wings and three shareable options like fried pickles or cheese curds. And then there's our aptly named over-the-top nachos. Yes, literally a mountain of crispy tortilla chips loaded with your choice of pulled pork or honey barbecue chicken, corn, jalapenos, and more. Then to top it all off with our new platinum margarita. That's the way you do it. Go overboard with us today at Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Available for a limited time while supplies last. And please remember to drink responsibly. And now here's my interview on the upcoming documentary 14 Back, which will be seen on SITV, SI Managing Editor Chris Stone and Director Jonathan Hock. Joining me now is my boss, the man who runs SI, Chris Stone, along with a special guest, Director John Hock. And we have a big announcement here for Sports Illustrated and in partnership with MLB and SITV, which you can subscribe to. Do you want to do the honors, Chris? Do you want John to do the honors? Do you want me to do the honors and announce what we're working on?
You can do the honors.
Okay, I'll do the honors. And it works out well. Yankees and Red Sox are on fire this season, and it looks like they'll be going down to the wire. So SITV and MLB are collaborating on a documentary. It'll be called 14 Back on the summer of 1978. And we know how things ended there for the Yankees and Red Sox. Bucky Dent, little home run that most people in New York couldn't get enough of. And very excited about this documentary coming up. John, do you want to give us a little rundown of what people can expect from it?
Yeah, I mean, this was, to me, I was 14 years old when it all went down, and a New Yorker, and Bucky Dent's home run was probably the happiest moment of my entire life until maybe I became a father, maybe. And the documentary that we're doing, though, is really it's a story that only becomes more hard to believe and more unimaginable if you're a baseball fan today. Every layer of the onion you peel off, there's just another detail that just blows your mind. I can't believe baseball was played that way. I can't believe a baseball player would say such a thing publicly. I can't believe that that a team was that great. A team was so terrible. The teams hated each other really so much.
Yeah. And still do, which is good for.
Yeah, they still. But you know, project. Today when they have a brawl, you know, Aaron Judge goes out and grabs like five guys and kind of neutralizes right. the whole right. situation. You know, everybody was throwing in 76 when they had the big brawl, mm-hmm. and they really didn't like each other, and there wasn't millions of dollars at stake if you know, ended a guy's career somehow. So it's like they didn't care as much about, you know, protecting one another. They weren't all in the same club. They hated each other.
And back then, players could be characters. In this day and age, players can't really be characters. Teams want them buttoned up. You don't see a lot. But I mean, back then you had George and Billy Martin and Reggie Jackson and more personalities that really didn't care about public perception. They did and said what they wanted.
Yeah, I mean, I think in Reggie and George, the owner of the Yankees, George Steinbrenner, and Reggie Jackson, wasn't the first free agent, wasn't the first big money free agent, but he was the ultimate free agent. You're talking about two people who loved publicity, thrived on publicity, who fed writers stories when there weren't enough stories about right. them in yesterday's paper. You know, Billy Martin, you had a guy who just couldn't control himself, couldn't stop himself from saying the wrong thing.
There's no way he would get a job today. There'd be no way a team front office wouldn't put up with that.
No, the vetting process
right. exactly
would not allow you to hire a guy like that. You know, Louis Tiant who was one of the great characters in this drama, who pitched when the Sox, which we'll get to, won their last eight games of the year to force the one-game playoff. Louis started three of those eight games on 3 days rest and won them all, including, I think, a three-hit shutout on the last day of the season. And then he played for the Yankees the next year, so he really knows everybody in the drama. But Louis said the thing that was the best about those teams is that the game would end and you would hang out together, go in the sauna, couple of six-packs, and you'd talk baseball. And you'd just talk about baseball together. And today, the game ends, the guys give their quotes to the press and get out.
Right.
And they don't become a club in the same way they used to because they're so afraid of what the writers are going to write for them.
Right. Plus, they can control their own narratives with social media now, too.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah. And then this was really – I don't know if there was a sports team before – the 77-78 Yankees that became fodder for gossip columns in the same way. I mean, Namath had his incidents, but they were kind of incidents. They weren't daily back page tabloid drama. And the writers from that covered the Yankees, they thrived on it. This was a meal. This was a meal ticket and a big one for them.
Yeah.
So they couldn't stop themselves either, and it became this frenzy of chasing stories, being fed stories. You got to get the story out before the other guy gets the story out, and the players didn't had never experienced it before. So they didn't defend themselves against it. They didn't protect themselves from it. Those who didn't want to be involved,
right.
And a lot of them just wanted to be involved.
Yeah, and such a different time back then too, where. When you mentioned giving the stories to, feeding the stories to the press, where people would not see those stories till the next day when they opened the newspaper, it's a whole. I'm looking forward to seeing that whole thing play out because it's such a different time than now, and you forget how things worked back then without this thing called the internet.
Jimmy, that's a great point. The newspaper men controlled the narrative.
Yeah.
Well, that's a really interesting point because. John's talked about the New York media here, but the Boston media was a very formidable, competitive, ferocious press corps. Gammons had just come back from Sports Illustrated, where he had covered hockey for a season, maybe two.
How's that for a nugget? Peter Gammons covered hockey for SI.
Well, the year before, Bob Ryan had covered the Red Sox in 1977, while Peter was at Sports Illustrated covering hockey, and that is very strange.
Yeah.
In 78, Peter came back and got his old job back. But in their own kind of provincial way, Boston media, they were kind of celebrities themselves, often as big or bigger than the players in some cases, dating back to the days of Ted Williams and even before then. And, while there wasn't the same tabloid culture that existed there, just the fact that Boston is a much smaller city than New York, and it's much harder for a Red Sox player to hide in Boston. Historically, this has always been true. In New York, an athlete can kind of, to some degree, fit into the larger city in Boston, it's impossible. And also Boston was perpetually the underdog.
Right.
At that point, they had not won a World Series for 60 years, I believe it was.
Yeah, it was exactly 60 years. And what the players feel, the players that we've spoken to so far, the Boston writers were kind of an extension of the fans. They were really the mouthpiece of the fan. And they hated you when you were losing, and when you were winning, they were waiting for the crumble. That's what Rick Burleson said to me. These guys were just waiting for the crumble, and they almost couldn't wait for it to happen. And when it did, they would kill you.
Yeah.
And in the Yankees, it was more who was saying what about whom, and the ridiculousness with the owner and the manager. It was really tabloid fodder, and not baseball writing.
Right.
But in Boston, it was, Burleson especially, he really is still wearing it. Like, they wore you out in Boston. He said when it was going well, it was the best place in the world to be.
Right.
And I'd never trade the 5 years I was up there for anything. But, boy, when it went.
Well, look what happened to Bill Buckner, you know, in 86. Yeah. I mean, practically.
That's when it really went over the edge.
Yeah, yeah. I want to ask you about the summer of 78 and what'll be highlighted. Before I do that, I'm going to ask Chris a baseball question, because you mentioned the one-game playoff. I'm just curious, because we've talked about how different things were then. Back then, American League, two divisions, no wild card, let alone two wild cards. So it was really, you had to win your division. There was no other way around it. What do you think is better for the game, the way it was then or the way it is now?
I think it's better now.
You do?
I really do. I just think it's... I think nostalgically we can say, you know, there was a much greater sense that you really earned it if you got to the postseason. But I just like the extra rounds.
Because if it was the way it is now, the extra games. That summer of 78 doesn't happen the way it, you know, unfolds with the one-game playoff.
I'm sure the Red Sox would have found some epic way of letting down an entire region all over again, even if they had gotten in with a wild card back then. But the Red Sox in 1977, which was the first year I started following baseball, I was a seven-year-old, and they won 97 games. They didn't make the playoffs. They finished 2.5 games behind the Yankees, who won 100. And they won 99 the following year. I mean, and we'll start getting into this. I mean, it was a remarkable start to the season. On July 19th, which was the point at which the Yankees were 14 back, the Red Sox were 62-28.
Wow.
They went one game over 500 the rest of the season. They won 99 games. Yeah. They didn't make the playoffs, which is nuts. Actually, this is probably a great opportunity to kind of talk about the debate we've had about the title.
Yes.
The documentary started out as 14.5 back because for four decades, really, this has been pushed. I don't know if it's a Boston thing or a New York thing, that the Yankees came from 14.5 down in July to win the division. And in Boston, you know, which probably enjoyed the opportunity to kind of self-flagellate even more, it's pushed. The Red Sox blew a 14.5 game lead that they held in July. So all these years, and I'm a huge baseball fan and a huge Red Sox fan, and I've never heard anybody suggest anything other than the 14.5 games that that was blown.
Right.
And this summer, and this is where Jonathan can take over the story, we're talking about the idea, and he said, I should probably share something with you.
Which was very disappointing to discover, because 14.5 back sounds so much more romantic than 14 games back. But the standings at the end of the day never show anything more than 14 back. So we say, okay, maybe the Sox won a game and went 14.5 up for a few minutes, or the Yankees lost before the Sox lost. Well, no, the Yankees, I forget which was which. I think the Yankees were in Minnesota and Boston was in Milwaukee.
Correct.
When this July 17th, it became 14 games. And then I think they were off the 18th and the 19th, they both played. They both won. And we thought, well, if the Sox won a minute before the Yankees, we could say 14.5 back.
But which is still stretching it.
But but it does appear that the Yankees won 4 minutes before the Red Sox won that night to go.
And that's what made people take 14.5 and run with it? Was the four?
No, it was 13.5. Then it went back to 14.
Okay.
And so it never went to 14.5.
So, I was going to say, how did 14.5 become this thing?
Some writer who we haven't discovered the story yet wrote that you know, they were 14.5 back. And
Jimmy, if any of your listeners come up with the answer to 14.5 back, they will get a research credit.
Okay.
Yes.
On a documentary.
We would love to show the story that says 14.5 back. Or if you can prove to us that our research is wrong and that the Yankees actually, the Sox won a minute before the Yankees won to make it 14.5 just for a moment.
I'm very intrigued by this.
We want that.
Is it possible there was a rain delay? Have we gotten that deep into the research?
Well, you know, the Baseball Reference lists the time the game started and the duration of the game, and we accounted for central time versus... I even went on eBay and bought a 1978 Milwaukee Brewers schedule.
Oh, my God.
To get the exact time that they started
you
the game.
You figure Elias would have... Elias or, I don't know...
The bottom line, Jimmy, is we still might end up calling it 14 and a half back just because we love the sound of it so much, and we'll explain it somewhere in the middle.
Well, can you put it 14 and a half back with an asterisk if you throw an asterisk in there? It's always
Billy Crystal's,
you know, tell me and the listeners, summer of 78, what are some of the things we'll be seeing or hearing about that took place in that will make the film, you think?
Well,
just besides, you know, Yankees, Red Sox, but what were the sort of little milestones throughout the summer of 78?
Well, the season starts with the Yankees defending world champions. Reggie Jackson has proclaimed himself the straw that stirs the drink in 77. Thurman can only stir it bad, he says, then says he was misquoted. And as when Thurman confronted him, Thurman said, misquoted for four effing pages. So he had a very tumultuous first year with the Yankees, ends up hitting three home runs in game six of the World Series, and all is forgiven and forgotten, it seems. The home opener in 78, Reggie hits a home run on Reggie Bar Day, where they actually, he had said, they'll name a candy bar after me if I come to New York. I'm that big. And sure enough, they did, and the fans who were given their Reggie bars showered the field with Reggie bars to celebrate Reggie.
It was probably the best use of the Reggie bar. It wasn't a particular. It wasn't an especially memorable delicacy.
I'm going to disagree. I think it was very much like the Baby Ruth bar.
But it fell apart. The nuts would just kind of fall out of the chocolate.
They weren't fresh by the time they reached Boston.
Just listening
to
this,
they were chewy and good.
It seems like a missed opportunity that no athletes get candy bars anymore. It seems like somewhat like, you know, there's got to be a Tom Brady, you know, avocado bar.
Performance drinks. Yeah. Avocado bar. That's a good.
The trout bar.
Yeah, something.
It just doesn't sound
good. It's got to be someone who's got like some personality behind them. No offense to Mike Trout, but like a Gronk. How does Gronk not have a candy bar? You know,
that's a good point.
Aaron Judge. He seems ripe for a candy bar.
So you got Reggie and the... that was 77.
So they come, you know, defending world champs, riding high. Defending Cy Young, or the returning Cy Young Award winner, Sparky Lyle, the former Red Sox relief pitcher, is now the Yankees relief pitcher, wins the Cy Young as a relief pitcher in 77. I think it was only the second time that it happened. And the Yankees get Goose Gossage as a free agent. So, imagine today you have a Cy Young Award winning closer and then the most expensive free agent out there who's the same position, you get him. So that's when Greg Nettles, his first of many great quips of the year, said Sparky had gone from Cy Young to sayonara. And so Goose then goes on to be the worst relief pitcher in baseball for the first 2 months of the season. He's blowing game after game.
When they fell 14 and a half back on the 17th, he blew a two-run lead in extra innings against the Royals, and I think he was 5-9 at that point.
And again, going back to how these were times too when he was doing 2-3 inning saves. It was not
just twice that year, 4 2/3 innings.
Wow.
And one game, big game against the Red Sox that they lost, a 17 inning game in August, 7 innings of relief by Rich Gossage.
I'd love to know the last time a closer threw 4 2/3. Forget 7. That is remarkable.
So, anyway, he's terrible. The Yankees are terrible. And the Red Sox, meanwhile, are
awesome.
Awesome. All-time awesome. Jim Rice is putting up numbers that haven't been seen literally since Joe DiMaggio. He finished that year with 400 total bases. It was the first time since DiMaggio in, 1937. But the Sox had added Dennis Eckersley to their rotation. Eckersley was, I think, 22 or 23. He had pitched 3 years in Cleveland, I think, and had a whole dramatic family story. He was partying too much and
Rick Manning, look it up.
And so at the last minute, they get him, and Eckersley is pitching his brains out for the Sox. It's actually his only 20-game season, his only 20-game winning
That's
season.
That's correct.
His career high in WAR was that year. All his great years with the A's, never had a year like this year with the Sox. So they have Louis Tiant, who's still in his prime. They have Eckersley. They have Bill Lee, who's won 17 games 3 years in a row. And they add to that mix Mike Torres, who was pitcher for the Yankees the year before and was on the mound when they clinched the World Series in 77. Now he's starting for Sox. And so the Sox are running away with it. And the Yankees are collapsing on the field and off.
And the Red Sox got off to, as I alluded to before, a remarkable start. 62-28 by the middle of July. But one thing that kind of got overlooked, and it ultimately really hurt them, is they had undergone an ownership change, which I think was a pretty leveraged purchase of the Red Sox by the Sullivan family. And even though they had stars top to bottom in their starting lineups, they had no depth. And this would hurt them in the summer because injuries which had killed the Yankees in the first half of the season would similarly kill the Red Sox in the second half of the season. And whereas the Yankees were a deep, versatile team, the Red Sox, you know, they were running the same lineup out there every day. They had no bench to speak of. And in part because they had let go of those kind of glue guys, those extra guys, most notably like Bernie Carbo. Now, wouldn't the Red Sox have loved to have had Bernie Carbo in that one-game playoff when they sent Bob Bailey up to the plate? But the Red Sox had a star-laden lineup that stayed healthy in the first 90 to 100 games of the season. And then they weren't healthy anymore. And then everything just fell apart. And, you know, by September, they're going into September, by Labor Day weekend, they're, what, still 3.5 up going into that series?
They're 4 up.
They're 4 up going into, and this is kind of a climactic point in the season where you could almost do a documentary unto itself about these 4 days in September, which sounds like a George Will type of book. But
it's
these 4 days in September.
It's a revenge film for Yankee fans against 4 days in October.
And I'll let John tell you about those 4 days because I really still can't bring myself to talk about those 4 days.
Well, let's first talk about the first of those 4 days. Because it was scheduled to be a three-game series. On July 3rd and 4th, the Yankees had a two-game series with the Sox. And this was the point of the season where the Yankees were a total wreck. Sox were flying high, no injuries yet. And on July 4th, they're scheduled to play in Fenway. And the Yankees don't have any pitchers. And they call up a guy from AA in New Britain, Connecticut, who had never pitched in the major leagues and would never pitch in the major leagues because the game was rained out. And if the game had not been rained out, no doubt the Sox are going to win that game. And that would have been win number 100 for them. By the time the Yankees and Red Sox play in September, this Thursday, it's or was it Monday? It was Thursday. They have to make up this game, and now the Yankees are on fire. The Sox are a little banged up and struggling, and feeling the pressure, hearing footsteps.
But remember, this is post Labor Day. You know, September's already started. We're full week into September, and they have a 4-game lead on, you know, the second weekend of September.
And they're saying to each other, let's just take two. Let's take two of four and end it. And the first game starts, final score, Yankees 15, Red Sox 3. All right, shake
message
it off.
Message sent.
The Yankees don't hit a single home run with the 15 runs. They're just, everybody is hitting. Game two of the series, Yankees 13, Red Sox 2. So now it's down to two games. And
at this point, if you have to take a look at the box scores for these two games. It's like Little League. The Red Sox made 7 errors that second game. And they were of the comical variety. These weren't like, you know, standard ball through the legs. This was like 4 guys circling in right field and a ball falls off of Dwight Effen's glove.
There are two moments in my life as a Yankee fan that I can remember just smiling to myself as I watched something. The second was in 2003 Game 7 when Grady Little came out to take Pedro out of the game and then turned around and walked back to the dugout and left him in. You just smiled to yourself as a Yankee fan. The first time that happened was in Game 1 of this Boston Massacre series. Butch Hobson was the third baseman of the Red Sox. Tremendous power hitter. He batted 9th in their lineup and hit 30 homers. They were that awesome, an offensive lineup. But Butch Hobson was a football player at Alabama, University of Alabama. And by all accounts, fantastic teammate, fantastic guy. Had bone chips in his elbow, like multiple bone chips floating around his elbow to the point where in any given moment he couldn't straighten his elbow all the way out. When you throw the ball, you need to do that. So he would have to throw the ball with a bent arm, and he couldn't control his throws. And he made 43 errors that season.
Wow.
And almost every one by throwing. And he had told Zimmer, like Don Zimmer, the manager of the Sox, like, "Zim, I can't throw the ball. You know, I want to go out there for you, but I can't throw the ball. You get on out there." Old school Zim. And what Fred Lynn said is that Zimmer was really intimidated by that Boston media that you mentioned before that would really come after you. So he never took guys out of games or gave guys a day off because he didn't want to catch any flack if they if he took a guy out and the replacement made a bad play and they lost the game. So he never rested guys, and he kept Hobson in the lineup at third base, didn't DH him all year. Finally, gets to September, and the second batter of that first game of the 4-game series hits a ground ball to Butch Hobson, and of course he throws it into the stands. And that was the moment as a Yankee fan you just smiled and said, "Here we go." And something in Boston just clicked the wrong way when that happened. So anyway, we're up to Game 3 now. Eckersley against Guidry. Guidry is having the greatest season a starting pitcher has had in the American League since, you know, certainly a left-handed pitcher.
25-3. Yeah.
25-3 he finishes. Yep. And this is the season that the rhythmic clapping on strike two starts in Yankee Stadium in May when he struck out 18 against the Angels. That's when that all began. But meanwhile, Eckersley is having like a Cy Young-worthy season in any other season. And it's 0-0 to the fourth, and they're two outs and two on. And Lou Piniella hits a pop-up, and it's in short right center. And there's a photograph where you see 6 Red Sox in like a perfect campfire formation around the ball as it falls to the outfield turf.
Right.
7 runs later that inning with 2 outs. Yankees 7, Red Sox 0. 2-hit shutout for Guidry. The first of 2 2-hit shutouts in a row he'll pitch against them that month. And then Game 4, which is known for all time in Boston as the Bobby Sproul game. Who is Bobby Sproul, you ask?
I don't know, but I heard he has ice water in his veins.
That's what Don Zimmer said about him, and maybe he did. But you have a team that has gone from 14 games up, hopefully 14 and a half again, someone find out, all the way down to 1. You've lost 3 games by a combined 33, somebody do the arithmetic, I can't do that. And you hand the ball to a guy who has never pitched in the major leagues. Zimmer says he has ice water in his veins. Bill Lee is begging him to pitch. Someone says Yastrzemski begged Zimmer to let Lee pitch. And for personal reasons, Zimmer was not going to do that.
So are you excited, Jimmy? Have we excited you for this?
I am very, very excited. I kind of wish it was coming out today. I'm looking forward to it for sure. We'll absolutely watch it immediately because there's just so much here and the personalities, the stories. It was that time and those teams. I have no doubt this will be hugely popular, and I'm looking forward to it. Can't wait for it to come out. Is there anything else we need to say about it? So it's either going to be 14 back or 14 and a half back.
It depends what your audience comes back with.
Yeah. And it'll be late summer on SITV.
October 2nd, right?
October
40th anniversary of Bucky Dent Day.
There you go. And
which was also Yom Kippur.
Little nugget.
Well, you don't forget these details.
No,
you forget.
Of course. Yeah.
You forget none of these details. You know, John was in temple that day atoning for, you know, having bought that T-shirt right at Yankee Stadium. And the Red Sox fans just didn't atone enough, apparently. You know, I mean, because I can still see the Yaz swing. He you know, it's crazy to say this about pop-up. He just missed it.
Fred Lynn was saying. He said 1 millimeter. He said it was a good swing. And when you hit it a mile high like that, you know it was a sweet spot. And it's just, if it's 1 millimeter lower on the bat, it's in the bleachers. And so that if that season came down to 1 millimeter, that was the right way for it to come down.
Well, that season, I think, will tell an excellent story. I'm really looking forward to it. Hopefully everyone listening to this is too. So that'll be 14 or 14 and a half pitches on SITV October
14
2nd.
And a half back.
14 and a half back. Where did I say pitches? 14 and a half back or 14 back. Why do I keep saying pitches? 14. Why do I keep saying that? 14 and a half back. Chris Stone and John Hawk, thanks so much. Looking forward to it. Get to work. Let's get this going. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Thank you,
Jimmy.
Thanks. All right, that wraps up this edition of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I'm your host, Jimmy Train. I thank you for listening. My thanks to the voice of the New York Yankees, John Sterling, and to Chris Stone and Jonathan Hawk. We'll see you next week. Take care.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.